Today is Wednesday, February the 26th, 2020. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. A shout out to the men and women serving in the military of our country. We thank them for their services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Tonight, we have a special show. In the IT Pro series by Benjamin Rockwell, it's part 1 of 5, Why IT Efficiency Gains. And from the Tech Corner, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is saying that Wi-Fi is safer today. Safer is not safe. And from Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, Marty forecasts more intelligent weather. But first, in the news, Google to crack down on location tracking apps, Huawei to develop an independent operating system for China, the Free Software Foundation pushes for Microsoft to release Windows 7 as open software, and Microsoft All-in-One Office app is released. Last week, Google announced they are cracking down on Android apps that track your location in the background. Apps will face a new review process to enable the feature. Google is placing new restrictions on which Android apps can track your location in the background with a new review process that will check whether an app definitely needs access to the data. Google says that all new Google Play apps that ask for background access will need to pass review, and it will be expanding to all existing apps. Although location tracking is an essential feature for many apps and services, it can be pretty invasive when apps indiscriminately ask for locations. Background tracking is even worse because it means that you might be completely unaware of which apps on your phone are tracking you at any moment in time. The new review process will force apps to justify why they need to use the feature and have them limit their tracking when they can't. Google says that this review process will look at whether an app core functionality actually justifies this background location access. A social networking app that lets user opt in to continuously share their location with friends would be okay. Google says, however, it would be harder to justify this for a store location app, since this would work just as well if it only got location access while the app is in use. Clearly, informing the user will help an app's chance of getting approval. The changes were announced as part of a wider crackdown on location tracking in Android 11, which follows in iOS 13's footstep by letting you grant sensitive permission on a one-time basis. Apple's operating system also offers reminders that apps are tracking your location in the background. However, these policies seemingly don't apply to some of Apple's own apps, which has been criticized by some developers. And just who do you think is tracking you big time? Google, of course. And of course, Google is criticizing those who are trying to track you. They should look in the mirror. In contrast, Google says that its policy will apply to its own apps. Okay, let's hope it's true. Which is reassuring given the company's less than perfect approach to location tracking in the past. Back in 2018, the Associated Press found that turning off Google's location history setting wouldn't stop all location tracking because of an additional web and app activity setting that would continue to track you. In response, last year introduced a new feature to allow you to automatically delete this location data automatically after a certain amount of time. In other words, it's not completely deleted. The announcement post also reminds developers that they're responsible for any third-party SDKs, which means the system development kits, and libraries they use in their apps. Last year, one study found that some apps were using these SDKs to track users, even when users had opted out of location tracking. Google says that developers can request feedback to see whether their apps will be able to justify background location tracking. Hey Google, check all your stuff first. Be the first to set a good example. Well, with all this squabbling with Huawei, where they cannot use the Android operating system, I guess what they have to do, which is create their own operating system. In China, American technology companies dominate the operating system market. Figures put Android at the top with a 52.81% market share, Windows is second with 31.97%, and iOS is third with 10.9%. However, in the future, the popularity of American software could start to diminish. Recently, Chinese software firms China Standard Software, that's CS2C, and Tianjin Kailin Information, that's TKC, announced that they would team up and combine resources to develop a domestic operating system capable of taking on the likes of Google, Microsoft, and Apple. According to a report by ZDNet, they're planning to launch and invest in a new company that will develop, market, and sell China's domestic OS. While the firms have not revealed much about the product at this stage, it'll be based on CS2C's Nikailin OS and TKC's Kailin. Both companies have connections to the Chinese government, which wants to ban all state PCs running on Windows by 2022. That's a pretty short time to develop an operating system in 2 years' time. The Chinese Communist Party Central Office issued the order last month following America's decision to blacklist China-based technology companies. With this in mind, what do these plans mean for the OS incumbents, and how do they tie in with the current U.S.-China tensions? It's a rocky relationship. There's no denying that China and U.S. have a difficult relationship in recent times. Multiple trade wars have erupted between both nations, with America particularly taking aim at Chinese technology firms like Huawei over security concerns. All this aside, Bolt Global CEO Jamal Hassam says they have an interlocked relationship and are mutually codependent on various core sectoral strengths to fuel their economies. I have no idea what he said. So basically, China, with a strong push from the government, will develop operating systems so that they would not have to depend on operating systems that comes from the United States. Not that they were paying for any license to begin with. The Free Software Foundation is suggesting that Microsoft upcycle Windows 7 as open source. The Free Software Foundation, that is the FSF, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization founded by Richard Stallman on October 4, 1985, to support the free software. The Free Software Foundation has kicked off an online campaign calling on Microsoft to make Windows 7 available to all users for free. Microsoft turned off the free software update taps with a final fix back in January 14th of last month. The foundation says Windows 7's life doesn't have to end. They called on Microsoft to upcycle it instead. The Free Software Foundation has kicked off an online campaign calling on Microsoft to make Windows 7 available to all users for free. They have petitioned Microsoft to undo past wrongs. There is a precedent. Ancient MS-DOS and Word code had been opened up and a calculator app found in the current Windows 10 now is in GitHub, but an entire relatively recent OS? No. Unfortunately, the FSF couldn't resist sarcasm, saying the killing of the OS had brought to an end its update, as well as its 10 years of poisoning education, inviting privacy, and threatening the user's security. Hey, if it's all that bad, why do we want this as open source? Suggesting such a release would go some way to undo past wrongs may not be a persuasive argument for the Seattle suits, who probably saw Windows 7 as a way of undoing the heinous deeds of Vista. There are some problems, not the least, the licensed components lurking in Windows 7 that would need to be either excised or open source as well. Then there are the bits and pieces that the company would consider valuable secrets, such as large chunks of Windows 7 linger on in Windows 10 after all. Then there is the fact that Windows 7 is not actually unsupported. 3 more years of update support are available for those who can pay, with Windows as well, those parts of its license to third party still account for a sizable chunk of Microsoft revenue. You can imagine a very functional and highly compatible free version is not really in the company's best fiscal interest. And let's be honest, who knows what's lurking in that code? The register contacted Microsoft on the off chance that Windows 7 might be showing up on GitHub at some point soon. But we were told that the company doesn't comment on rumors and speculation. The Windows 7 request from FSF is neither rumor nor speculation. In any event, if open source is your thing, there are plenty of Linux distributions in a far better state of usefulness than what was around when Windows 7 was first launched. And if there is that Windows app that you just can't do without, the popular compatibility layer of Wine received a bump to version 5, replete with over 7,400 tweaks to allow you to inflict more Windows apps on your Penguin Tinge operating system. Still, never say never. If you told us 10 years ago that Microsoft would be about to ship a version of Windows containing the Linux kernel, we might have been laughing it up and drinking our beer until we were silly. So who knows what else might be coming down the pike. Microsoft's all-in-one Office app is now available to all. It's available now for Android and iPhone. Microsoft's all-in-one Office app is ready for prime time. The mobile-first application, which the company announced last November, has already been available as a public preview. That version was limited to Android users that sign up through a specific Google group and 10,000 iOS testers that registered via Apple's Test Flight program. However, the consumer-ready Android app slipped into the Play Store earlier this week, and a little earlier than planned. A Microsoft spokesman said the iPhone version is officially out of beta for now, and the Android app has limited tablet support, and there's no iPad-specific version. As the name implies, the Office app combines Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. The software is more than a glorified app folder, though. There's a home screen, for instance, that lists every file you recently created, edited, or accessed across the three apps. It's a simple but Microsoft hopes useful feed that will help you keep track of your schoolwork or your personal projects. In theory, you'll spend less time rummaging through apps and more precious minutes refining your documents. At the bottom of the screen, you'll find a plus icon that reveals three additional options: Note, Lens, and Documents. The first creates a post-it style note that is immediately added into your chronological feed, or add a note to the Office file that you might need later. Curiously, though, this feature doesn't use or support Microsoft OneNote service. A spokesperson for Microsoft admitted that multiple testers have requested this feature and promised that the Office team would take it under consideration. For many cable subscribers, they have internet service, scheduled TV programming channels, and for many, the additional service for telephone access. When the term cord-cutting is used, it is really the alternatives available in lieu of TV reception from the cable operators. And the more appropriate term is not cord-cutting, but how do I cut down my monthly TV costs? When cable television was expanding, it was how many channels you can have beyond the local antenna broadcast area reception. Over time, the ever-increasing number of channels increased monthly subscription costs beyond the tolerable threshold expense for TV viewing. Most TV subscribers only view 10 to 14 channels. They want a skinny selection of channels, not a massive number of channels which in reality supports the many smaller channels that you don't access. Cord cutting for many is dropping or cutting the number of scheduled TV programming channels from the cable company's set-top box. Instead of scheduled TV viewing, many have switched over to viewing programs of their choice by streaming. It is demand viewing. Others continue to view scheduled TV programs by switching from the traditional TV platform to a platform receiving reception on the internet. Some combine these alternatives by combining it with over-the-TV broadcasts. Instead of the limited local broadcast channels, the viewers can now expand the number of local stations' receptions to a much wider perimeter. This is being made possible with a new ATSC standard being implemented for over-the-air reception. The number of subscribers for traditional cable service have dropped in ever-increasing percentages each year, and in some areas in the country, cable TV subscriptions are now in free fall. With cable in free fall and live streaming failing to compensate, the big cord-cutting story in 2019 was outright defection from pricey TV packages. Last year was the start of a major turning point for cord-cutting as a record number of people abandoned pay TV bundles outright in favor of cheaper streaming services such as Netflix. Now that all major cable companies, satellite providers, and media giants have reported their fourth quarter earnings, we have a full view of how bad the damage was. Over the past year, total U.S. pay TV subscriptions dropped by 2.7 million, even factoring in growth from live TV channel bundles such as Hulu, Plus TV, and YouTube TV. From 2018 to 2019, pay TV subscription was roughly flat. These numbers are based on the earnings statement of the largest U.S. pay TV providers, Comcast, Charter, Altice, AT&T, Dish Network, and Verizon, along with official and estimated subscriber numbers for Sling TV, which is owned by Dish, PlayStation View, which shut down last month, AT&T TV, now Fubo TV, Hulu, Live TV, and YouTube TV. The members don't account for smaller cable providers or for sports free streaming service, Philo, which has never shared subscriber figures. What's behind the decline? Well, let's start with the obvious: cable and satellite TV. It continues to get more expensive as TV networks raise programming costs. Last November, the Lightman Research Group reported that customers were paying $109.60 per month on average for traditional TV service, up about $3 per month from a year earlier. In December alone, Comcast raised its broadcast TV fee, an extra charge that the provider often excludes from the price it touts in ads, from $10 per month to $14.95 a month. And during 2019, Charter raised its own broadcast TV fee twice, from $10 per month to $13.50 per month, and AT&T, meanwhile, has grown more reluctant to extend discounts to traditional TV subscribers. In the past year alone, it lost nearly 3.5 million DirecTV and U-verse subscribers, more than any other traditional TV provider. None of this would matter much to the TV industry if live TV streaming services were picking up the slack. But 2019 was the first year in which they clearly failed to do so. While traditional TV providers lost about 5.5 million subscribers last year, live TV streaming services only gained about 2.75 million subscribers, indicating that half the people who dropped the conventional pay TV did not replace it with an equivalent live streaming service. Finding that only about 40% of traditional TV subscribers converted to a live TV streaming service. In other words, a significant percentage of cord cutters aren't just abandoning cable and satellite TV, they're opting out of bundles entirely, possibly spending some of the money they saved on new options such as Disney Plus. And that makes sense, given that live TV streaming has also been getting more expensive. Hulu plus live TV, YouTube TV, and Fubo TV all raised prices by $10 per month last year, while Sling TV raised prices by $5 per month across all of its packages. Over the year, prices for AT&T TV Now, formerly DirecTV Now, rose by a whopping $25 per month as AT&T seemingly lost interest in competing for price-sensitive customers. Last year's defections are just the start of what will be considerably steeper declines over the next year or two. Although a TV bundle is still required for most local sports, the best programming is increasingly available outside the bundle through services like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus, and CBS All Access. That trend would only accelerate with the launch of AT&T's HBO Max and NBC's Peacock in the coming months. Suddenly, people are just going to say, why are we paying for this? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Part 1 of 5, Why IT Efficiency Gains.
Why do we need computer nerds around the office anyway? This is something I've heard before in my career. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to spend a little bit of time covering professional information technology topics. This is where I give you experience from my 30 years of being an IT professional. This is part 1 of 5 in regards to why businesses need the nerds. Why they need information technology. Now, for some, this is going to contain brand new insight. For others out there, this is going to be just a reminder for you. Still more, hopefully we'll hear this voiced and expressed in a different way with different ideas popping into their heads. I do want to know what you think, so please do write me here at the show. Topic one amongst this five-part series is communication with your customers. First and foremost, in the business world, if you want to be competitive, if you want to take on all of the different people that are out there, you need to communicate. There are a number of different ways to communicate. There are a number of different ways that we can deal without information technology, but most of them today are second on the list, third, fourth, fifth, eighth, 27th on the list. Email, still the number one method for communicating. 25 years ago, we didn't worry about email. We didn't have email at most companies. It was the infancy of the internet. Today, information technology provides many different routes beyond email. And we all know that email is the key item there. See, you have to communicate with your customers. You have to be able to interact with them quickly and clearly. So, yes, there's the email. There's also instant messaging. Instant messaging is rising up in a number of different ways, in a number of different sections of our world. Sometimes it's a matter of you going to a website, you get instant support. We see this all the time. You go to any car dealer website, they will have a chat available for you. It's an instant message. It's somebody who's there all day long. Well, it's not the one, same person all day long. It's somebody available to answer questions in regards to your Mercedes, your Ford, your Chevy, your whatever it is that you've got. And that actually is all controlled, amazingly enough, from a central location. It's part of a service that's provided to all of these different dealerships. And there are people who are specialists in that particular type of car. To some extent, they're not going to know every little nuance of the car, but they'll be able to get you on the right track for many questions. This is just one example of communicating with the customers, and it's done through a website, the websites themselves. Now, we're moving away from the static website. We've really discovered that there needs to be additional support items on many sites. Most sites these days, most businesses that are huge, are starting to look into that forum concept. And that forum concept allows people to ask questions, but also interact with other fans. This is a great delivery of a service that goes on out. It allows for the owner of the whatever product that's out there to not only manage all of the problems, but have an insight in their own area as to what could be going wrong with their various systems. Another area with communication, we've seen this, the fast shipment options, where people can gain next day shipping on their products. We couldn't do that if we didn't have information technology. We can see what is available, how many different widgets that we can buy right away, because information technology is built into the website. It's built into the shopping cart, and it allows us to deliver, yes, to the customer, to deliver whatever quantity they want, so long as we have it in stock. And then, oh yes, if we don't have widget A in stock, maybe they'll choose widget B or widget C or D. It allows for more options. It allows for our customers to have greater power in buying from us. And sure, you may not have regular customers like we think of standard consumers, but we all have customers. Whatever we do, whatever business we deal with, there is always a business and a customer relationship. A hospital, the business is the doctor. The customer is the patient. Internal help desks, support desks, nerds like me, we're the business. The end user of the Windows system or the Mac system, they're the customer. And it's up to us to communicate with them. It's up to us to make sure that we have a number of different ways for them to reach out and to get their computer resolved, their problems taken care of. When customers use technology to interact with a business, you know who benefits? The business. Better communication with your customers and with other people creates a much stronger image for the company. It creates a much stronger image for the department, for everybody involved. And it allows for speed of communications that we haven't had ever before. Yes, believe me, I'm a firm believer that we need information technology in every business. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There was a recent article that was titled, Why Public Wi-Fi is a Lot Safer Than You Think. And, well, I kind of disagree. As most people know where I stand on Wi-Fi, it's either safe or not safe. A lot safer doesn't mean that it is necessarily safe. Well, let me get into the article. If you follow security on the internet, you may have seen articles warning you to beware of public Wi-Fi networks in cafes, airports, hotels, and other public places. But now, due to the widespread deployment of HTTPS encryption on most popular websites, advice to avoid public Wi-Fi is mostly out of date and applicable to a lot fewer people than it once was. The advice stems from early days of the internet when most communication was not encrypted. At that time, if someone could snoop on your network communications, for instance, by sniffing packets from unencrypted Wi-Fi or by being the NSA, they could read your email. They could also steal your passwords or your login cookies and impersonate you on your favorite sites. This was widely accepted as a risk of using the internet. Sites that use HTTPS on all pages were safe. Well, they claimed to be safe, but such sites were vanishingly rare. What is HTTPS? It is a secure way to send data between a web server and a web browser. Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure is the secure version of HTTP, which is the primary protocol used to send data between a web browser and a website. The protocol is called Transport Layer Security. HTTP by default operates on port 80, whereas HTTPS by default operates on port 443. HTTP transfers data in plain text, while HTTPS transfers data in ciphertext. HTTP is fast as compared to HTTPS because HTTPS consumes computation power to encrypt the communications channel. Is it safer? Yes, but I would not use it for financial transactions. To me, it's either safe or not safe. Safer is just, I don't know. However, starting in 2010, all that changed. Eric Butler released FireSheep, an easy-to-use demonstration of sniffing insecure HTTP to take over people's accounts. Site owners started to take note and realized they needed to implement HTTPS, the more secure encrypted version of HTTP, for every page on their site. The timing was good. Earlier that year, Google had turned an HTTP site by default for all Gmail users and reported that the cost to do so was relatively low. Hardware and software had advanced to the point where encrypting web browsing was easy and cheap. However, practical deployment of HTTPS across the whole web took a long time. One big obstacle was the difficulty for webmasters and site administrators of buying and installing a certificate, a small file required in order to set up HTTPS. EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, help launch Let's Encrypt, which makes certificates available free. Meanwhile, lots of site owners were changing their software and HTML in order to make the switch to HTTPS. And now, 92% of web page loads from the United States use HTTPS. In other countries, the percentage is somewhat lower. 80% in India, for example, but HTTPS still protects the large majority of pages visited. Sites with logins or sensitive data have been among the first to upgrade. So the vast majority of commercial, social networking, and other popular websites are now protected with HTTPS. There are still a few small information leaks. HTTPS protects the content of your communications, but not the metadata. So when you visit HTTPS sites, anyone along the communications path from your ISP to the internet backbone provider to the site's hosting provider can see their domain names, for example, wikipedia.org. But when you visit them, parties can't see the pages you visit on those sites. Your login name or message you send They can see the sizes of pages you visit and size of files you download or upload. When you use a public Wi-Fi network, people within range of it could choose to listen in. They'll be able to see that metadata just as your ISP could see when you browse at home. If this is an acceptable risk for you, then you shouldn't worry about using public Wi-Fi. And if you're using Wi-Fi for financial transactions, it is definitely not safe. Similarly, if there is software with known security bugs on your computer or phone, and those bugs are specifically exploitable only on the local network, you might be at somewhat increased risk. The best defense is always to keep your software up to date so it has the latest bug fixes. So what about the risk of governments scooping up signals from open public Wi-Fi that has no password? Governments that survey people on the internet often do it by listening in on the upstream data at the call routers of broadband providers and mobile phone companies. If that's the case, it means the same information is commonly visible to the government, whether they sniffed it from the air or from the wires. In general, using public Wi-Fi is a lot safer than it was in the early days of the internet. With the widespread adoption of HTTPS, most major websites will be protected by the same encryption regardless of how you connect to them. To recap, if you have sensitive data, confidential data, financial data, then wireless communications is definitely not safe to use.
Today, you can expect rainy weather with a high of 49 degrees and a low of 44 degrees.
Presenting Marty Winston as he forecasts more intelligent weather. Hey, Marty, what's the weather for today?
So, how's the weather? I mean, what are the chances? And, isn't it all just a lot of unpredictable chaos? As it turns out, yes. But thanks to AI, some big changes in weather forecasting are about to hit. Now, let me take you back to 1962. I'm sorry, this is radio. Back to 1962, when one of the learned faculty at MIT, a fellow named Edward Lorenz, a mathematician and a meteorologist, published a sizzling page-turner. Maybe you've heard of it. Titled, Deterministic Nonperiodic Flow. No, you don't recall that title? Well, within it is the origin of a term that's become considerably more memorable, the butterfly effect. A butterfly flapping its wings 100 centuries ago might be influencing the weather tomorrow. It's impossible to know. Lorenz also concluded that accurate weather prediction is an impossibility. Of course, I may be glossing over something here. By the way, I just used the word accurate, and that's wrong. If I were to tell you that every day for the next 366 days, the outdoor temperature in New York City will be between 50 degrees below zero and 200 degrees above, that will almost certainly turn out to be an entirely accurate prediction. And it is certainly not a precise prediction. Precision and accuracy are not at all the same, but they're often confused. And as for forecasts, well, start with the weather right now. If I ask you what's the weather going to be like in 30 seconds, I think you're going to get it right almost every time. How about what it's going to be like in 30 minutes, 30 hours, 30 days? The farther out you get, the less precise, the less accurate you can be, and that's part of the point. I reached out to Weatherflow. I'll have more to say about them later. And their chief scientist, Jeff Copeland, PhD, who added more precision to my description. His comment, quote, Lorenz's butterfly effect says that the ability to make a prediction at a particular time and place will degrade with time. So an hourly forecast will be good for the first few days, but essentially useless after 1 week, end quote. Of course, computing power has dramatically improved since 1962. So has the quantity and quality and immediacy of source data, especially when you consider the improvements in satellite and radar. What do you do with all that data? There are companies and agencies across the world providing their own answers to that. In general, they each start with the equations, the math that represents the laws of physics in the atmosphere. That gets finessed into a variety of computer models of how it all should work. They'll run the same data through dozens of these models and get that many forecasts, then do a statistical analysis across those, like voting, to determine which of the forecast outcomes are most broadly favored. In short, they involve computers in highly educated guesswork. And as Lorenz suggests, forecasts tend to be pretty good for pretty soon and borderline stupid for the long haul. So those hour-by-hour forecasts may be acceptably precise for today and tomorrow, but not so much for 10 days from now. Jeff Copeland adds, quote, "Shame on you, AccuWeather, for the 45-day forecast." That said, still him, that said, certain statistics of the longer forecast can be very useful. For example, will 2 months from now be warmer or colder than average? Will a snowstorm hit sometime next week? End quote. I didn't pick Weatherflow by accident. They're pioneering some exciting ways to involve machine learning and artificial intelligence in a new approach to weather forecasting that self-corrects and always improves. Let me walk you through it. The basics are easy enough. I'll invent a term, rearcasting. If forecasting looks ahead, rearcasting looks behind. Imagine you were to go back to one particular place and time and look at all of the measurements, all of the data that got thrown into models to come up with forecasts for that date and time. But at the same time, you check out the reality. You look at the weather that really happened, and you figure out how good or how bad that had been forecasted. Think about comparing the old observational data, the on-the-ground truth from networked weather instruments, to what the forecasts had predicted. It's kind of a sweet spot for applied machine learning, especially since you can get some very high horsepower computing to churn through mountains of data from all kinds of places at a given time or all kinds of time at a given place and so on. Scoring and weighting and other artificial intelligence techniques can look more broadly for patterns of when predictions tend to be right and when they tend to be wrong. Of course, there are flavors of wrong, too high, too low, too soon, too late, and that can lead to some very positive results. Remember, we're talking about recognizing those patterns of weather data that exhibit a demonstrated tendency to lead forecasts astray. And you know that today's computers are really good at pattern recognition, so you may be able to guess what comes next. The computers learn those patterns and the kinds of errors they produce. When they recognize one of those same patterns occurring again, the computers can adjust the forecast to compensate. How much adjustment? It can learn that too, through more trial and error, and it doesn't have to wait for more weather. There's plenty of data already available. Remember, after all, weather is a set of data that grows by the minute. Let me add, this approach can also learn to integrate factors from other data sets. If, and I'm just guessing here, but if the hole in the ozone changes size or shape in a way that lets computer analysis see the same dance steps happening in weather patterns, that can become a forever factor. Do solar winds matter? Holiday travel patterns? Military actions? If they do, machine learning and pattern recognition and artificial intelligence can embrace the data and step by step make forecasts increasingly precise and accurate. Over time, this approach keeps identifying errors, adjusting, making productive improvements, and reducing the sources of disagreement among the various weather forecasting models. It's ongoing improvement from repeated squeaks and tweaks, and I think it's brilliant. But wait, does this sound like just theory? It's beyond that. I'm going to quote an official description of the Weatherflow system approach. It says, "The key is to have quality observations to compare predictions to reality. Weatherflow will efficiently expand geographic coverage of weather observations, curate and qualify the data with a range of data science techniques, and leverage the data using machine learning and artificial intelligence to dramatically improve forecast skills over time." They also told me they will make their curated data sets available without fee to NOAA, National Weather Service, and other national meteorological agencies to aid the development of global forecast models, and to climate scientists working for the greater good. Know what I saved for dessert? I got briefed on the details of the impressive new Weatherflow Tempest Weather Service product that hits the market in a couple of months. It has no moving parts. It measures air pressure, humidity, temperature, rainfall, wind speed, wind direction, solar brightness, and UV brightness. Wind speed gets measured by ultrasonics with a 0.1 mile per hour resolution, 1/10 of a mile per hour. The wind direction resolution is 1 degree, 1 degree of circle. Rainfall gets measured by haptics using multiple piezo sensors. The temperature sensor mounting has been engineered with deliberate airflow to help reduce strange readings from the sun heating the housing. The electronics and the battery can handle high temperatures beyond what people can handle and cold temperatures to beyond 35 below zero. The battery is lithium titanate, LTO. It's an electric car technology, battery technology, with an ability to still accept charging down to that 35 some below temperature. It gets its charge from a cluster of vertically oriented solar cells, striping the sides of the sculpted cylindrical case. A lot of people find that counterintuitive, but really it's clever. Snow won't accumulate like on a horizontal panel. In the warm months, when the sun is more directly overhead, that extra solar brightness provides more than enough charging even at that narrower vertical angle. And during cold weather, when sunlight is less intense, it's angling in from lower on the horizon where the vertical panels are the most efficient way to capture. Pretty smart. The outdoor piece connects over a two-way sub-gigahertz radio connection. Sub-gigahertz, I'm thinking 900 megahertz somewhere, to a Wi-Fi-connected hub that can be hundreds of feet away. The hub can handle computational corrections that come to it over the internet, meaning the daily tweaks that result from all that machine learning and artificial intelligence analysis. Oh, they're also building two variations on that hub. One is a storm-ready, fire-ready version with a 7-day battery backup and fallback, failback routing over a cell service connection so it can keep communicating even when power lines and internet service are down. The other is for seldom visited, very remote, autonomous use. That one puts the hub in a waterproof enclosure with its own solar plus battery power source and a prepaid cellular plan good for at least 2 years. But you might wonder, what about privacy? What if you don't want to be sharing your data with everyone else? Well, if you don't want to, you don't have to. But if you are willing to share, Weatherflow has a program that can let you collect $15 a year for it because the data has value. Next time, we'll be on the other side of the leap year, marching forward. Depending on how quickly I get responses to my queries, I may have more to share about the new era of TV viewing options and how it's confusing many consumers and twisting what to expect from familiar products. Or I might be talking about the new wave of gear to measure indoor air quality and why that triggers responses from fear to fun. Or just maybe I'll get those clever LED fixtures mounted the way I want them to be. Believe me, the shortcomings are in me, not them. I'm Marty Winston, and I approve this message.
Thank you, Marty. The 45th Trenton Computer Festival, Saturday, March the 21st. The College of New Jersey, Ewing, New Jersey. The original personal computer festival is from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. The topic of presentation is How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Artificial Intelligence. It's an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force with an eye towards a significant positive impact on our world. And there are other feature tech talks and workshops, which includes do-it-yourself home automation, tricks and tips for Windows 10, quantum computing, WordPress bootcamp, New Internet of Things using 5G, stock market trading using neural networks, hands-on Arduino workshop for beginners, all-day robotics pavilion, and many more. For more information, tcf-nj.org. That's the 45th Trenton Computer Festival, Saturday, March the 21st of this year. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut Tri-State Region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. All these computer club meetings that we announce are open and free to the public. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on Why Switch Your Old PC? Running Windows 7 to Linux. Thursday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Cutting the Cord, the Future of TV, Tuesday, March the 3rd. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, March the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Hidden Gems, Thursday, March the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, March the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, March the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU, located at 32 Waverly Place, the Silver Building, Manhattan, New York. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, Benjamin Rockwell, and Mark Leoso, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy till we meet again, same time, same station next week.